water pounded against my face, and I held on all the more tightly. And then I was out of the ship and completely submerged, whipping around, closing my eyes, and trying not to gasp reflexively from the shock of the chill water and the violence of the spin. I wanted to cry out. I wanted to curse. Either response would have been fatal. So instead, I sank my teeth into the inside of my lower lip and found myself praying to beings whom I had nothing but contempt for. At that point, I even recalled the time when I crossed a stone bridge into the land of Wilwyn and had fancied I'd seen sea gods raging at me from either side as the waters had surged around me. They seemed rather annoyed with me at the time. I wondered bleakly if they carried a grudge. I tumbled about, lost track of which way was up and which was down. I figured that I had some measure of safety since wood floats. Then I thought about the fact that the boat I'd been on was most likely going to sink like a rock, and suddenly the buoyancy of wood had been called into question. Trying not to panic, even as I felt the air beginning to burn in my lungs and seeking release, I let out a few bubbles and watched them float. They trickled away in the direction that, had I been left to my own devices, I would have sworn was down. Perhaps the gods were perverse enough to reroute air bubbles to lead me astray. I put nothing past those poxy bastards. Nevertheless, I decided to trust in what I laughingly referred to as nature, and I kicked in the direction of the bubbles, keeping the table tightly under me. There seemed to be nothing but darkness ahead, and I was becoming more and more certain that I was simply steering myself to a dark and soggy death in the pit of an inky blackness that was the ocean. And then suddenly, I was up and out. Bobbing to the surface under a night sky that was alive with lightning all around. I looked down and saw that my staff was still wedged beneath me. I was relieved. That walking staff and I had been through a lot together, and I would have been loath to lose it. I bounced up and down like a leaf upon the rough waters.
Help! Help!
I managed to twist around enough to see the ship in the distance. The laugh was listing wildly, and I could see sailors tumbling into the water. They were so far away that I couldn't even hear their screams against the storm, and so ceased my own, realizing that all I'd do was hurt my throat. Then I saw something that will always stay with me. I in the crow's nest, I saw Captain Stout. I was certain it was he, even as far away as I was. He was clutching onto the mainmast, and he was saluting, making no effort to abandon the ship and save himself. Not that he would have likely had much opportunity for salvation. For some reason, I was certain that he was smiling as I watched the mast slowly descend into the water. Seconds later, the ship rolled over onto its side and then sank without a trace. There was no indication that there had been a vessel there at all. Here I'd sat down to a simple, foolish game, and as a result was stranded in the middle of nowhere on a plank. All thanks to Ronald McDonald.
I deserve a break today.
I've spent a considerable portion of my life drifting, essentially. Never before, however, had I found myself in a position where I was doing so literally rather than figuratively. It was somewhat ironic, really, although I'd noticed that irony is something better appreciated from a great distance of either miles or years, or both, and best appreciated when it's happening to someone else. In this instance, it was happening to me. Then again, why not? Everything seemed to happen to me. I had to admit that for all I mourned my unceasing hideous luck, I also possessed the most uncanny streak of good fortune that any fool had ever been blessed with. Over and over again, I would be thrust, all unwilling, into the mouth of danger. Once again, for no damn good reason, I'd survived it. The former incident was bad luck, the latter good, which led me to decide that I was the luckiest bastard on the face of the planet, since my luck ran so extremely in both directions. It was now simply a matter of finding out which aspect of my luck was going to be holding sway for the duration of my decidedly disturbing ocean voyage. I clutched tightly to the table, skimming over the choppy waves as best I could. Every so often, I would be completely submerged, and I would wake to be dragged down to the bottom, a nameless watery grave. How fitting, for one whose greatest boast throughout his life was that he had nothing.
Captain
I pulled my feet up to make sure they were clear of the water, and checked that my sword and staff were still with me. I also had a skin of water attached to my belt. After my experience in the tragic waste, it had just become force of habit. Out of curiosity, I cut my hand and dipped it into the ocean, and then tried to drink it. It tasted salty, as one might have expected, and not especially palatable. So, I took a judicious sip from my water skin, even though my impulse was to suck it dry. Then I waited. What was I waiting for? I hadn't the faintest idea. I had no reason to expect the ship to come along and rescue me. I had no real means of paddling. I could use my sheathed sword as a makeshift oar, I supposed. But what direction would I head? The ship had been going east. I looked up at the sun. It was still low to the horizon, so I knew the approximate direction that east was, but so what? And so I lay there. And lay there. And lay there. The sun finished its arc and night fell once more. The silence was deafening, just the steady lapping of water against the table and my labored breathing. That was it. I fell asleep and dreamt of Cherie and of Morden. I dreamt of the Princess Entropy and the court of King Runcible. They were pleasant dreams, which was surprising considering I didn't usually have pleasant dreams. In the taunting night vision, I was back at Runcible's court, except this time everything had worked out. I was respected, loved, admired. I was dancing with Entropy, and people were bowing and smiling whene'er I passed. And my mother was alive. She was standing to one side, grinning at how much her great and glorious son Apropos had accomplished. Mordred was on her shoulder.
Your destiny.
I woke up. It was night, but I could sense that the sun would soon be rising. It did. It crossed the sky. More tedium, more of the same. Why, oh why, hadn't I thought to keep some sort of non-perishable food items upon me? Wouldn't that have made some degree of sense? I castigated myself for that, and soon I was chiding myself for everything else in my life that I had done wrong or foolishly. It was a considerable list. What was interesting was that in virtually every instance, I found someone else to blame. Poor Apropos. Never to blame for any foul deeds or unfortunate happenstance that befell him, for they were always the fault of someone else. This was certainly not a new mindset. Nevertheless, for the first time, with no one else around to voice my frustrations to commiserate with, it seemed rather, I don't know, hollow. It wasn't as if I had always been my own greatest enthusiast. My loathing for the world was generally superseded only by my self-loathing. But when you're adrift on a piece of wood, even self-loathing will only take you so far. Sooner or later, you begin to wonder, why?
Why?
If life is so terrible, why not do something about it? Find options. Look for new ways to approach it. If there was one thing I knew, it was that I was a rather ingenious individual for searching out alternatives to dealing with assorted predicaments. It had gotten me this far, hadn't it? Granted, where it had gotten me was a piece of wood in an ocean in the middle of nowhere, but still, the point was that less inventive people would have been dead long before this. Most of my approach to life was filled with a desire to be left alone. Beyond a steady appetite for vengeance on those who made my existence a living hell, I really didn't aspire to anything other than to let others get on with the business of adventuring, fighting, and killing each other. Leave me be. Don't drag me into it. Don't look at me. But was that reasonable? I had become the physical embodiment, the epitome of that philosophy. I had achieved the perfect state of isolation. There was certainly the downside of having no food and a very limited supply of water, but let us say that I had both in abundance, through whatever means, mystical or natural, you could devise. Let us say that the constant concern over inclement weather and the resultant speedy death were not a consideration. Let us say, in short, that pure survival was not a concern. It left me looking upon an endless vista and saying, "Is this all there is?" I was an island unto myself. I was my own best friend, my own beginning and my own end. I was the ultimate in isolation, and the humanity for which I held such contempt was a distant and irrelevant consideration to my life. It was a perfect existence for one who disliked so much. I had to say, it wasn't much fun. I stared down into the watery depths, hoping perhaps that some stray fish would pass by and I could snare it. Once I managed that feat, I had no clue what I would do with the damn thing. It wasn't as if I could cook it. I could certainly eat it raw. I consumed raw and nearly raw animals before when making a fire wasn't feasible. It didn't sound particularly appetizing. Then again, the way my stomach was feeling, just about anything should have been appetizing. By the time of the third morning, I was ready to eat plankton. By the time of the fourth, I was ready to eat plank, specifically the board of wood upon which I was floating. I had never been so hungry in my life. The temptation to gulp down the entirety of the skin's contents was becoming overwhelming. I was going to die. I had no doubts on that score. What purpose, then, to dying thirsty as well as hungry? How would I be served by that? I drifted in and out of sleep, regardless of time of day. The dream about the party at King Ratzebel's court was becoming more and more expansive. By this point, everyone was there. Everyone who had ever tried to kill me. And that alone was enough to fill a fairly sizable hole. Everyone who hadn't tried to kill me was there as well, although they took up a considerably smaller portion of the room. Even within the context of my dreams, I was impressed by the staggering number of people who had, at some point or another, desired to see my life terminated. It was quite an accomplishment, in a depressing sort of way, to have found the means of annoying so many people. This time, however, they were all dressed in black. They were smiling, though. It seemed to me some sort of bizarre combination of funeral and banquet. I wandered through the crowded hall, drawing no looks or conversation. It was as if I wasn't there. That figured somehow. To be a non-entity, even in a figment of one's own imagination. People were crowding in around a table, and I pushed through to see what they were looking at. I saw myself lying in the table, done up like a prize pig for the slaughter. I was on my stomach, my eyes dead and glazed. For that matter, the rest of me was glazed as well, cooked to perfection. I had an apple in my mouth. Cherie was standing there with a large fork and carving knife, preparing to slice me up. Others were leaning in with plates and eager expressions. I awoke into daylight and realized I no longer knew for a certainty how long I'd been floating out there. I wondered how long it took for the human body to turn on itself, to start devouring itself when there was no means of sustenance around. I thought I'd heard somewhere that 2 weeks was the maximum. I brought the water skin to my lips, not without effort, to eke out my meager rationing. Ooh. There was nothing in it. Delicacy gave way to franticness, and I shook the skin desperately, trying to obtain a few more drops of moisture. Nothing. Bone dry. I'd finished it. I was finished. However long one could survive without food, I knew that continued existence without water was an impossibility. Water, water everywhere, but none to quench the thirst of apropos. More irony. I was getting well and truly sick of irony. I twisted myself around, bringing myself to a sitting position, ready to toss the water skin into the ocean and myself along with it. Then I saw it. I stared long and hard, thinking that perhaps this was an illusion of some sort. Then I rubbed my eyes and looked again. It was land, far distant and not directly to the east, but more to the northeast. It was large, whatever it was. Not a simple, small island, but something more substantial. With newfound strength, invigorating my exhausted limbs, I grabbed my sheathed sword and started paddling with it. I held onto it with all the feeble strength that remained to me. The last thing I wanted was to lose my grip on the weapon and watch it slide away into the depths. I paddled, and paddled until all my muscles were so sore that I had to put the sword down upon the port lest I lose it. The land seemed no closer. I couldn't even be sure it wasn't farther away. To be within sight of possible salvation and not be able to do anything about it other than stare at it from afar. It was almost more than I could bear. Then I heard some sort of curious splashing from behind me, as if something was moving through the water in a very direct manner. I shifted myself around on the table and looked behind me. At that moment, my thirst and hunger were forgotten, replaced by an overwhelming sense of blind panic. Something was definitely heading toward me at a significant speed. The only part of it that I could see was the exceedingly large, triangular, curved gray dorsal fin bearing down upon me. I had never seen a shark in my life, but I certainly knew of the creatures. If you were on a sailing vessel, you had a modicum of protection. If you were just swimming or adrift, you are more or less screwed. In my case, I was leaning closer to more than less. My limbs shook with terror as I envisioned that monstrous mouth sinking its teeth into me. I ceased my vain attempts to use my sword as a paddle and instead pulled the blade from its sheath. The sword seemed to glitter in the sun, eager to be pressed into service. For all I knew, it was going to be the last time I endeavored to use it. The creature sporting that fin might loom out of the water with a maw wide enough to swallow me whole, or drag me down and just hold on to me as I thrashed about helplessly and my lungs exploded. But I was not going to go down without a fight. I watched carefully, my arm trembling from the strain of waiting. Waiting for just the right moment.
1, 2, 3.
Suddenly I decided to bring my sword back and try for a sweeping slash rather than a thrust with the point.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
I swung the sword down as hard as I could, anticipating the creature's lunge.
Oh my God!
It came up out of the water, and its face was pale and gray, and quite human-looking, as was its torso, and it had human arms as well. It most definitely was not human, however, but rather some bizarre kind of mer-creature presenting itself to me, its arms wide as if greeting a long-lost friend. All of that took a second to register on me. Unfortunately, in half a second less than that, my blade cut through him like kelp. He was looking at me in unbridled joy, with eyes as black as the ocean's depths, and then, startled, he looked down. He appeared quite puzzled to see the gaping wound in his chest, and the black blood seeping out of it in copious amounts. He looked back up at me.
Oh, I came to worship you!
All right, now, to be fair, I thought you were attacking.
I was swimming!
Yes, but you were swimming very menacingly. Look, I admit, I might have been a bit hasty.
You have no idea what I've been on a quest through 100 tides. I have searched.
Oh, God, not someone else's damned adventure again.
Through untold menaces, searching for the one who was foretold to...
Please stop. You're giving me a headache.
The mortification at my haste in slaughtering what was clearly not a predatory creature, but instead my potential salvation, was bad enough. But now he was prattling on about quests and menaces and such, and it was just making matters worse. As guilty as I felt, I was starting to regret I hadn't decapitated him. Then again, the day was young.
The foretold one! The drifter with the pale skin, whom I would bring back to our island home, and we would worship and serve his every whim, provide him with every luxury until the end of his days.
Well, we can still do that. There's no need for this quest of yours to end on a down note.
He fixed his fading gaze upon me. He was starting to sink, but with his last dregs of strength, he held on to the edge of the board.
Now I realize the prophecies played me false. You are, in fact, evil incarnate.
What? Just because I accidentally killed you? As if that's never happened to anyone.
My people will know you for the destroyer that you are. And they will attend to you.
Look, I would really like to go back to the worshipping an island thing, if that's okay with...
I clapped my hands to my ears and rolled over, tried not to scream in pain, and failed miserably.
Shut up! You'll deafen me!
I grabbed my staff and rapped him soundly on the top of the skull with it. It didn't take much more than that, since he'd seemed barely alive anyway. He lost his grip on the board and slipped beneath the surface. I watched him sink, but lost sight of him almost immediately.
All right. This really wasn't my fault.
And indeed, I was reasonably sure that it was fair to say that. Yes, in my lifetime, I had stolen and lied and cheated. I had taken advantage of women, slaughtered men, behaved in a consistently cowardly manner. But for once, I felt I really had an excuse for the misfortune I had brought upon the poor bastard. He'd been on a quest and it ended badly. 'Tis to weep. He should have done more to announce himself before drawing within range of my blade. That was all there was to it, and if anyone asked, that was exactly what I would say. That was when the water began to churn beneath me. I sheathed my sword, secured my staff, and held on as the waves surged. I imagined it to be some sort of current that would, in short order, pass. I could not have been more wrong. Instead, it grew in intensity and force, and the ocean began to buck fiercely as if it was trying to expel me from it. The waves became so choppy that they literally flipped me into the air. My clothes immediately became soaked through, my eyes stinging from the salt. I squeezed them tightly shut and then opened them. In the distance, but coming toward me quickly, was a series of gigantic waves. And silhouetted in the waves were gargantuan beings who bore a resemblance to the one I'd just killed, but much, much larger. 20, maybe 30 times bigger. The dead creature had obviously summoned them with his series of whistles, which it carried considerably well through the air, and I had a sneaking suspicion he had not painted a favorable picture of me. They were barreling straight toward me. Because of their vast size, they were churning up waves. They were bigger than some castles I'd stayed in. They were huge, capable of swamping me in a heartbeat if they caught up with me.
He should have done more to announce himself before drawing within range of my blade.
They seemed unimpressed by my explanation as they continued to bear down on me. I threw myself flat on the board, facing away from them, and started paddling madly with my arms toward the distant shoreline. My progress remained depressingly slow, and then suddenly I realized I was starting to speed up. The water was surging, carrying me faster and higher. The water threw the board to one side and the other, and I realized that by remaining flat, I wasn't going to be able to control it. I got to my knees, remained that way, my arms paddling even faster. My speed increased, no thanks to me, and every thanks to my briny pursuers who were descending upon me. I did the only thing I could. I clambered to my feet, even though my right leg was lame. But at least I was able to use my left to manipulate the board, steady it, prevent it from flipping over. The waves blasted toward me and I continued to ride on the crest, being carried at higher and higher speeds towards the land. And then the waves caught up with me. I kept the toes of my lame right leg resting gently, using it for steering and guidance, counting upon the strength of my other leg to provide the sheer muscle of balance. The waves tried to push me sideways to drive me away from the land, but I saw a crusting wave that was going where I wanted, shifted my body weight, and sent the board skipping through a virtual tunnel formed by the water. I was down and through, and I tilted yet again, driving myself hard toward the land. The creatures were howling for vengeance, for my blood, They hadn't even met me and they wanted to kill me. Usually people had to get to know me a little before they wanted to kill me. Suddenly, I was turned completely upside down. I couldn't keep my feet on the board, couldn't control it all. And then the wood, my only salvation, skidded away from me. I flipped twice in midair, miraculously managed to keep grip on my staff, and then crashed into the water. Swimming was, to put it delicately, not my strength. So I was reasonably sure that this was it. I was going to die. There was absolutely no way I was going to be able to survive splashing around in the ocean. Even left to my own devices, I wouldn't stay afloat for very long at all. And those creatures, whoever and whatever they were, weren't going to give me the luxury of time. I sank. And my feet hit bottom. However, when they did, my head was still above water, as was everything above my waist. I staggered forward. I tried to lean on my walking staff, but it sank into the sand, and it was all I could do to pull it out. I looked around in bewilderment to discover that I was not more than 8 feet from land. The combination of the pure power of the waves and my adeptness at using the board to navigate them had resulted in me winding up exactly where I'd wanted to, namely, any place except where I'd been. I realized the creatures were almost upon me. They had not remotely given up. I splashed desperately towards the shore, and then another wave of aquatic force hammered me, sending me tumbling. I went under. Reminded myself that I was in relatively shallow water, hauled my head up, and pushed myself forward. Slowed by exhaustion, spurred on by desperation. Exhaustion and desperation warred with each other for a moment, and then, as it so often did with me, desperation won out. I threw myself onto the shore, falling and rolling from the water as fast as I could. It surged onto the sand as I rolled frantically away. I crab walked backward up the shore, watching the way I'd come, looking for some sign of the waterlogged monsters that had driven me hither. Nothing. Whoever, whatever they were, they seemed to want to have no truck with the surface world. I couldn't entirely blame them. Many was the day that I likewise wanted to have no truck with the surface world. As much as they might have allowed their silhouettes to be seen in the huge waves, when it came down to it, they preferred to remain hidden. I still needed something to eat, and even more, something to drink. At that moment, though, all I really wanted to do was rest. Which is what I did. Once I pulled myself securely out of the range of the tides, I flopped onto my back and fell into a dreamless sleep. Apparently, I had just been that tired and filled with relief upon making landfall. Miraculously, no one had disturbed me in my slumber. Then again, I'd been lying flat on my back, so no one could have reached my sword. And I didn't see why anyone would want my staff, particularly if they weren't aware of the special weaponry built in. Other than that, and the clothes on my back and an empty water skin, I had nothing. Now that I landed, the first thing on my agenda was water. I hauled myself to my feet, all my joints registering an aching protest. My clothes were still a bit damp, but the temperature in this place, whatever that might be, was quite warm. So my vestments would likely be dried off in very short order. I looked around, trying to assess just where the hell I was. It was not some small puny island, that was for sure. It stretched as far as I could see. Not only that, but even from a distance, I could see that there were signs of civilization. Small wafts of smoke drifted in the breeze from what I reasonably was sure were home fires. I took some measure of comfort that there were fires burning, and I didn't have to worry about whether I was responsible for setting them. There was a grove of trees obscuring my view, however, so I couldn't see what type of villages or residences lay in the distance, or even how near they were. Then I stopped and stared at the trees in wonderment. They were unlike any I'd ever seen. I drew closer to make certain that I was viewing them properly. It was as if a grove of walking staffs had sprung up. Tall and supple they were, more than 100 feet high by my guess, with great green sprouts coming out of the top. The trunks were jointed every foot or two along their length. I wasn't even sure if trunks was the right word for them. Shafts might have been more accurate. I could wrap an entire hand around even the largest of them. They were swaying gently in the breeze, rustling softly, and if I had not been sure before that I was in some strange alien land, this was more than enough to convince me. I pulled on one of the trunks experimentally. It moved with my tug, swung right and left, but did not break. I pulled again, harder this time, and was deeply impressed with the strength and resilience of the wood. If wood it was, as slender as it appeared, I could see that it was remarkably durable and did not break easily. I pulled it toward me with as much strength as I could, and all it did was bend. Finally, I released it. And it smacked me in the face. I rubbed my nose, and despite the fact that I was bone-weary, still smiled at the mental picture of how ludicrous I must have looked at that moment. My hearing remained sharp, as always, and I was reasonably certain I detected the faint trickle of water. My mouth was too dry to salivate, and I was so excited by the prospect of quenching my thirst that I nearly passed out from excitement. I made my way briskly in the direction that my ears told me the water lay. Every so often, I would glance up once more, marveling at the walking staff forest surrounding me. The trees were not particularly close together, so maneuvering was a fairly easy chore, even for me. Eventually, just over a rise, I heard water rushing, even stronger than before. I clambered over it, and sure enough, there was a narrow river, the most glorious thing I'd ever seen. The water looked crystal clear and pure, and I almost broke my good leg scrambling down to it. Finally falling flat on my stomach and shoving my whole head into it. I made the mistake of laughing underwater and got a nose full of water for my troubles, but I didn't care. The river was quite shallow by the shore, and I rolled myself into it so that I was facing in the direction from which the river was flowing. Keeping my head elevated, I simply allowed the water to cascade into my mouth. And I swallowed it in great eager gulps. I had been so parched that I wouldn't have thought it possible I could ever drink my fill. But finally, I was indeed sated. Just to play it safe, I took my water skin and held it underneath until it was filled as well. And then I noticed something drifting toward me from upstream. It was a little ways out in the water. I waded out a few steps and then used my staff to snag it and bring it in close for me to pick up and study. It was a boat. A small wooden boat, as a child would have. Nothing fancy. It looked like a miniature canoe. I looked in the direction from whence it had come. I wasn't sure whether to go toward the origin point of the toy or away. I finally decided that a meeting with the locals couldn't be forestalled forever. Sooner or later, I was going to have to deal with whoever it was that was residing hereabouts. A pocket lined the inner folds of my cloak, so I tucked the boat in there and started following the shoreline. The day continued to be warm, and I was actually beginning to feel relatively good about myself. Such a frame of mind was always dangerous for me, for it was usually when I was in good spirits that huge storms of shite would rain down upon me, courtesy of the gods on high. It was easier and safer for me to remain a pessimist. Nevertheless, there was a spring in my limping step that wasn't usually there. My thoughts were continuing in the direction they'd been heading earlier. Here I was, still alive. The number of incidents threatening my life that I'd survived was starting to border on the epic. It was almost enough to make me wonder if I really was intended for something great. Then again, for me, just surviving from one day to the next was something of an accomplishment. Although the sky was clear, a thin mist of rain began to fall. I pulled my foot up to keep myself dry, a ridiculous goal, I admit, considering I spent practically the last week being soaked. Before too long, however, the rain was letting up. The walking staff trees started to thin out, and I soon found myself on the edge of some sort of field. A stiff but gentle breeze to my back helping to dry me off. The field was filled with stalks of something that came just over my head, thickening at the top. They were thin and white and wavering, and sure smelled sweet when the wind came right behind the rain. But I had no clue what they might be. I continued on my path, and soon I was starting to detect sounds of humanity, mostly female. That sounded promising. The river rounded a bend, and I came around it and saw an assortment of women, all young from the look and sound of them, standing knee-deep or near the shore. They appeared to be washing clothes. The outfits they themselves wore were almost entirely white. White, wide-sleeved robes, it seemed, with the bottoms hiked up and tucked into wide sashes or belts wrapped about their waists. Beneath those, they sported loose white leggings that came down to the knees. Furthermore, on their heads they wore extremely curious, wide-brimmed hats that were so flat they looked like large plates that came to a point. I couldn't be sure, but it seemed to me that the hats were constructed from the same material that the staff trees were made of. There were a few children there as well, dressed in simple one-piece knee-length white tunics, playing quietly as their elders tended to their wash and chatted amongst themselves in a language I couldn't even begin to comprehend. I was able to pick up languages fairly quickly, but I was a stranger in a strange land, and it would have been nice to be able to communicate with someone. I tried to tell myself that it wasn't necessarily a disaster, even as I noted that their skin color was slightly different from mine. More of an odd tint. Slightly yellow, it seemed. I reasoned that perhaps they had some sort of vitamin deficiency that caused their skin to retain such a curious hue. Then one of the women happened to glance in my direction. The poor creature was deformed. Something was disastrously wrong with her eyes, or perhaps her eyelids. They looked almost slitted, although they opened wide enough upon spotting me. Certainly, I reasoned, it was some sort of strange, unfortunate birth defect that had caused this to come to pass. My heart immediately went out to her in a way that only someone who has been born deformed could possibly feel. The others turned and looked at me as well. They all looked like her. So did the children. It was far worse than I had thought. I had wandered into something akin to a leper colony. Someplace where people who had been born with this disfiguring condition had been sequestered so others wouldn't have to look upon them and be as thoroughly disconcerted as I. They looked no less stunned to see me than I to see them. The children were calling to their mothers and pointing to me to their own eyes in obvious bewilderment. The women were shaking their heads, gesturing helplessly, having no answer to give their inquisitive youngsters. That's when it finally dawned upon me. I wasn't in some area where deformed people had been cast out from a more round-eyed society. Everyone in this land looked that way. As far as they were concerned, I was the freak. They were probably more right than I was. After all, I had never seen anyone who looked the way they did, but they apparently never had seen anyone like me. And there were a lot more of them than there were of me. Then I heard more voices, deeper, rougher, male. They were coming from the field all around, and I felt the situation was deteriorating rapidly. I started to turn with the intent of heading back down the river, and suddenly my retreat was cut off because the males of whatever they were had emerged with stunning silence from the fields behind me. There were five of them of varying ages, and they seemed no happier to see me than I was to see them. They were obviously warriors, holding some sort of weapons that were totally alien to me. They were gleaming steel, held by handles not unlike daggers. They were longer than daggers, though, but shorter than short swords. They looked somewhat like miniature tridents, with the prongs weren't of equal length. A spike protruded from the middle, and the guards consisted of two smaller upturned twists of metal, one on either side. Everyone was talking at once, and naturally I didn't understand a damn word any of them was saying. On the other hand, I knew an attack when I saw one. They were advancing slowly, babbling to each other, moving in a tight formation. I didn't like the odds I was facing. I reached around to my pack and yanked free my sword. They jumped back, startled as the blade whipped around, and I held it in a guard position. "Just keep your distance!" I shoved my cloak over one shoulder to clear my sword arm. And as I did that, the little boat I picked up downstream fell out of the inner lining of my cloak. It fell to the shore and lay there. I turned just in time to see a small girl dash toward me, oblivious to the chance of danger that might be presenting itself. Obviously, it was her boat.
Jun
was either her name or their language for get the hell away from the man with the huge sword. Whichever it was, she blissfully ignored it, indicating that she was either an independent thinker or else stone deaf. She ran right up to the boat, not more than a foot or so away from me. If I'd been of a mind to, I could have whacked her head off with one blow. Instead, I simply stood there, sword still poised, but making no move toward her. Why in the world would I have done so? I was no slaughterer of innocents. All right, technically, I was a slaughterer of innocents, but it had been a bad year. The child picked up her boat and smiled, clearly happy to have recovered her toy, which had apparently gone sailing away from her. Then she turned and looked up at me and grinned. I suppose I should have grinned back, but instead I just stared at her, not quite knowing what to make of her and the whole situation. Then she startled me as she briskly slapped her arms to either side of her body and bowed stiffly at the waist. I wasn't about to lower my sword. This still didn't have the makings of a friendly encounter. Nevertheless, while keeping my weapon in a guard position, I stiffly mimicked her bow. She bowed once more. I bowed once more. Seemingly satisfied with that, she splashed back across the shallow river to the woman whom I assumed to be either her mother or elder sister. By that point, all the cross-talking and incomprehensible chit-chat had ceased. Instead, silence hung in the air, as the people were clearly uncertain what I wanted, and I didn't have a clue what they wanted, and we didn't have the language skills to bridge that gap, or so I thought. Then, one of the men took a step or two toward me.
Huh.
It was a sort of noise to get my attention, to announce that an attempt at communication was about to be made. He indicated the sword in my hand, mimed stabbing with it, and then shook his head in a firm negative manner. One of the women, I remember, had likewise shaken her head. It was comforting to know that there were some universal constants, and shaking one's head to indicate a negative was apparently one of them. His meaning was clearer. They were all put by my sword. They wanted me to put it down or sheath it. They considered it a potential means of attack, which it bloody well was, of course. They were armed as well, of course, remember, with their pointy steel sticks of death. I wasn't about to leave myself vulnerable to assault, so I shook my head vigorously. I'm not lowering my guard. You have weapons too, you know. I pointed at the lethal objects they were carrying. There were bewildered expressions for a moment as they exchanged looks. Then one of the men, an older fellow whose hair was as straight black as the others, seemed to understand something. I doubted he suddenly spoke my language, so I waited. He held up his lethal fork, and I raised my blade in automatic defense.
Huh.
Then he said something in his language that I couldn't hope to comprehend while pointing at his own weapon. I shook my head.
I don't understand what you're saying.
For some reason, he spoke louder and more slowly, as if addressing one who was either deaf or stupid or both. Again, I shook my head. Everyone was watching the fellow, apparently waiting for him to get across to me whatever it was he was trying to say. Then he went down to one knee upon the shore and slowly drew the point of his weapon along the ground, churning up the dirt. Watching me intently as he did so, he then took the weapon and stabbed the longest prong straight down, making a small hole. Then he held his hand over the hole and waggled his finger as if he was sprinkling something into it. I watched him blankly for a long moment. He pointed at the hole in the dirt, then at the white stalks that stood upright nearby. And damn me if I didn't suddenly, in a burst of comprehension, understand what he was saying.
You mean those aren't weapons. They're farming implements.
They used them as miniature hoes to turn the ground and dig holes into which they would drop seeds from which these stalks had grown.
Warriors, my ass, you're farmers. Ha!
Very slowly, hoping I wasn't making a disastrous mistake, I sheathed my sword. Watching me put my weapon away, they visibly relaxed. There was still tension in the air, but it seemed as if the immediate threat had passed. The same man who had so deftly mimed the planting of seeds then spoke to me once again. He gestured wildly, pointing in various directions, looking at me and shrugging in bewilderment. But it was an artsy sort of bewilderment, meant to put across a mindset. Clearly, he was inquiring about from whereabouts I had come, since I was so obviously foreign to their land. My mind raced, and then I suddenly turned to the girl who had so fearlessly approached me earlier. I snapped my fingers to gain her attention and gestured that she should come back toward me. She automatically started to do so, but her mother briefly restrained her.
Janju!
What about me?
The man was apparently trying to put across to her that everything was going to be all right, clearly as a matter of trust. Perhaps the man was her husband or some other relation. She released the girl. The child came toward me, and I went down to one knee at the water's edge. I put out my hand and pointed at the girl's boat. She hesitated only a moment and then handed it over to me. I held it upon the water's surface, pointed at the boat, and then pointed at me. The man's face clouded for a moment, but then cleared and he nodded in understanding. I had been a passenger on a sailing vessel.
Hold on.
Obviously, I wasn't about to go into detail as to specifically what had transpired to shipwreck me. Even if I spoke their language, I doubt I could have made them understand it. I barely understood it. Instead, I simply indicated the ship's cruising along and then suddenly angled it sharply downward and pushed it under the water, conveying the notion that my vessel had gone down. He nodded excitedly to show his comprehension. I then mimed swimming gestures, gasped deeply to indicate exhaustion, and then walked two fingers in a staggering fashion up onto the riverbank to put across that I had made it to shore. The man spoke not to me, but to his people. Obviously, he was explaining to them, for any who might be mime-impaired, the short version of my ordeal. A foreigner with a strange face, surviving a disastrous voyage and managing to make it to shore of an unknown land. It was a dramatic notion, certainly, and one that served to make me a most sympathetic figure. The most pleasant aspect of the whole thing was that it wasn't a lie. That was nice for a change of pace. Many were the times I'd come up with some sort of fabrication to gain the sympathy of someone new I'd encountered. In this instance, the truth of what I'd endured was terrible enough. The man shoved his farming implement into his belt and came toward me. His movements were not the least bit tentative, but instead open and welcoming. He stopped a few feet shy of me, and I watched carefully, not wanting to make any sudden moves. He brought his hand around and placed them palm to palm, fingers straight up and in front of him. Then he bowed in a manner similar to the way the girl had done. Slowly, I got to my feet with the aid of my staff, having been down on one knee all this time, and handed the toy boat back to the child. I imitated the bowing gesture. Then, deciding to take the chance, I slowly extended my right hand, palm sideways. He stared at it, then mimicked the gesture with his hand so that it paralleled my own. We stood there for a moment, both our hands sticking out, looking rather ridiculous. So I brought my hand over to his, wrapped it around his gently but firmly, and slowly shook it up and down in the traditional gesture of my people to show that neither of us had weapons in our hands. His expression was one of utter befuddlement. He started to shake my own hand more emphatically, so emphatically, in fact, that our hands jerked up and down in a far greater arc than was standard for a handshake. I didn't let it concern me, though, since the primary intent was clear. And so it was that I fell in with a village of farmers in a foreign land. People who knew nothing of my checkered past, who didn't know me as a bastard or a knight of dubious reputation, or a vicious warlord who had waylaid to more cities than he could possibly count. A man who had ruined hundreds of lives and cut a swath of destruction through the world, leaving misery and unhappiness in his wake. A man who had been desired dead by just about everyone he'd ever met in his life. Here I was, just a stranger, a refugee, a man who had survived a terrible mishap when his ship had foundered, and yet had managed to endure. As odd as it seemed, apparently I'd found a home, however temporary, among people who were not my own and were happier to see me than those who were my own. The cynic within me knew that it could not possibly last. Worse, that I'd probably do something to make a total mangle of it. At that moment, though, I didn't care. It felt good, and it hadn't felt good in a very, very long time. And so it was that I came to reside in the land I eventually determined was called Chinpan, a land of mystery and rituals and a way of life totally unfamiliar to me, practiced by people whose very physiognomy was alien. Then again, I'm sure that I didn't exactly look normal to them either. That was all right, though. With my irregular features and pronounced limp, I was used to looking not normal. My facility for languages served me well over the next months, as the villagers made a priority of teaching me how to speak their language of Chimpanese. Some of them showed some mild interest in my own tongue, but overall the concerted effort was made to work with me so that I could learn to communicate with them. It certainly made sense for me to learn their language rather than they learning mine. There were, after all, far more of them. The name of the village I had learned was How's Bayou, and the population couldn't have been more than 75, if that. The village was situated at the intersection of two man-made dirt roads, well-worn grooves in them as a result of frequent passages with ox-drawn carts. Several of the beasts grazed in a field nearby, along with a couple of cows that probably fulfilled the milk needs of the populace. All the structures were simple huts or simply larger buildings that served as barns, and the exteriors appeared familiar. Then I realized they were constructed of wood from the tall, flexible trees I'd seen earlier. It was one of the first words of their language that I managed to learn. Bamboo, it was called, and it was an extremely ubiquitous material. In addition to having been used in the fashioning of their buildings, they also built fences with it to hem in their cattle. Thinner shoots of the plant had been used to make those strange flat hats. Some of the women wore shoes made of bamboo, and I even saw some of the young men sparring with one another with bamboo as quarterstaves. I took great interest in the material, thinking of the myriad uses it could have been put to back in my own native land. The man who had worked so mightily to establish communication with me brought me to his hut, where his wife eyed me warily even as they hastened to prepare a meal for me. It was very touching. They didn't have much, but what they had, they were willing to share, even if all they were sharing was a bowl of rice. I'd never been particularly fond of rice, but considering I thought I was going to die of starvation on a plank in the middle of nowhere, it could not have tasted better had it been manna from heaven. Through a combination of more pantomime, drawing primitive pictures in the dirt floor and the like, my host managed to inquire as to what my plans were. The truth was, I had no plans. I had no overwhelming urge to return home. To what home precisely would I have returned? In my native state of Asteria, I was persona non grata. I certainly couldn't return to Wooen. I had no loved ones to be concerned about an extended absence, and the number of people I knew in Chimpan was limited to those whom I'd met that day. So I managed to get across to him that I had nowhere else to go and nothing else to do. If I did have some sort of great destiny, it was going to have to seek me out in How's Bayou, because I didn't have the slightest idea where to go to look for it. The man nodded, apparently comprehending. He and his wife left the hut after a while, and when I went to the door some minutes later, I looked out and saw what seemed to be the entirety of the village gathered in the middle of the place, where the two roads intersected. Then someone pointed at me, they all stopped, and looked in my direction. I didn't know why they'd ceased conversation. It wasn't as if I could understand them. Still, it was obvious that I was the topic of discussion. They were trying to figure out what the hell to do with me. I withdrew into the hut, having no wish to disturb them. Certainly annoying them would be counterproductive to my best interests. I had no doubt that I could fend for myself if I had to. Still, not speaking the language was going to be a major handicap. I hadn't survived as long as I had through dazzling fighting skills, that was for certain. My strength was the quickness with which I could come up with the right lie to spin for any given situation. If I couldn't make myself understood, all the quick thinking in the world wasn't going to do me any fragment of good. I wasn't completely inept when it came to physical defense, but robbed of my ability to obfuscate and bewilder, the likelihood of my longevity was greatly curtailed. So it was with a certain degree of nervousness that I waited to see what the village's consensus about my fate would be. An interminable amount of time later, although in reality probably wasn't all that long, my host returned to the hut and looked at me contemplatively for a moment. A group of his fellow villagers was standing behind him. I said nothing. What would I have said? He put out a hand, and one of his neighbors handed him one of the pronged farming implements that I originally thought was a weapon. His expression was very serious, and for a moment I thought I'd misjudged the situation horribly. and they were about to charge me and try and drive the weapon through my chest. My sword was on the ground a couple of feet away, but I resisted the impulse to lunge for it. My host walked toward me, turned the tool around so the hilt was facing me, and proffered it. I hesitated and then reached for it, taking it gingerly from his hand. I hefted it slightly. It was surprisingly light. With gestures, he indicated that I should tuck the tool into my belt. I did so. Then, collectively, they placed their hands face to face and bowed. The message was clear. If I was willing to pull my own weight, to work their fields by their side, I was welcome to stay for as long as I wished. My heart swelled. Never had I experienced such unbridled generosity. The closest I had come was when Queen Bee and King Runcible had extended an invitation to be a squire in the court. But even in that instance, a squire was one of the lowest of the low, and the other squires never missed an opportunity to make me feel like the titleless, unlanded peasant that I was. This was a totally different circumstance. I was being invited to join a community as an equal, no questions asked, even if questions could be posed. For an inveterate cynic like myself, it was almost too much to cope with. I contained my roiling emotions and instead simply returned the bow. They smiled and then walked out of the hut. My host's wife paused long enough to offer a genuine smile. Even she had overcome her hesitancy and seemed willing to welcome me if the others were. Those who have been following my adventures know me well enough to be fully aware of exactly what started preying upon my mind. What was going to go wrong? It was too perfect, too wonderful. Despite my tendency to be thrust into adventures, I really had no overwhelming compulsion to embark on them. Yet they always seemed to overtake me. Always. Part of me wondered whether I didn't bring it upon myself somewhat. The closest I'd known to peace in some years was when I was an innkeeper at a place called Bugger All. My tenure there had ended rather disastrously and, of course, thrust me into yet another escapade. But even before that happened, I had found myself growing bored with the quiet existence I was leading. In retrospect, I couldn't help but believe that on some level, I had brought it upon myself. Which, of course, made me immediately start worrying about what new disaster I would bring down upon myself. It wasn't just myself that I had concern for. The people of House Bayou were unstinting in their generosity and total in their acceptance of me, despite my obviously different appearance. Wherever I go, disaster tends to dog my steps. Typically, I'm the only one who suffers, or at most a loved one who had the poor fortune to be in proximity to me at the time. But this was an entire village, filled with good people, all of whom seemed to be named Chin. At first, I thought everyone was related in some manner. That was hardly a heartening notion, that all the villagers were siblings or cousins lying with each other and producing more spawn to engage in further incestuous relationships. I was assured, however, that it was merely a coincidence, that Chin was an exceedingly common name, with Chen a very close second, and Wong coming up in the rear. Over time, I learned their first names even as I learned their language. It was a challenging tongue to master, particularly since they had words that sounded the same but had different meanings depending upon inflection. And their names could be stunningly similar as well. Yes, over a period of months, I could readily distinguish Nabaharu from Nabohisa, from Nabahito, Yoshitaka from Yoshitaki, from Yoshitoki, because I had faces to associate with the names. You, the dear listener, might have a far greater difficulty keeping everyone sorted out through the narrative. I don't say this because I think you're somehow mentally deficient or less clever than I. Although, to be candid, the very fact that you continue to exhibit such morbid interest in my life and waste precious time listening about it when you could be doing something of more importance, such as, well, anything really, does indeed call your intelligence into question. For that matter, you very likely are less clever than I. Forgive the immodesty, but I like to think my having survived to old age is a testament to the fact that I've raised cleverness to the level of an art form. Nevertheless, in order to simplify your following of my humble narrative, I will spare you the sound-alike names of the villagers and instead refer to them in the way I first thought of them. You see, for my own amusement, until I memorize their real names, I tended to refer to them by various appropriate nicknames that stem from the universal Qin surname. I would even occasionally address them as such, and naturally they never comprehended the shadings of meanings. For instance, my host, to whom I've referred before, was somewhat jowly, so I dubbed him Double Chin. His wife, who seemed to enjoy the noontime meal the most, I called Lan Chin. Lan Chin's sister was the woman who had tried to control her daughter during my first encounter with them, to little avail. She was even more obsessed with the details of food preparation than her sister. She became Kit Chin. Her daughter, the one whose boat I had found, I naturally called Kitchenette. The town's nominal leader, a belligerent gentleman with graying hair and a perpetually suspicious air, I called Take-On Chin. His undersized, constantly complaining wife, as you can surmise, Bitchin. There were other villagers, such as Fetchin, Inchin, Clefchin. You get the idea. What could I say? It amused me. It didn't appear to bother them in the slightest. And it helped me feel at home. And I came to like them. You have to understand what a major development that was for me. I tended to dislike people. Intensely. All people. I could look upon them and try to imagine the darkness in their souls and conceive of the ways they would turn upon me given the slightest opportunity. They were people of the land, extending their hospitality and making me one of them. And if something happened to me, the chances were it would happen to them, which put me in a unique position, that of worrying about someone other than myself. As can happen with any new concept, it became overwhelming. I could think of nothing else. Weeks passed into months, seasons rolling over into season. I would lie awake at night in the bamboo hut I had built with their aid. I would envision flames consuming their village, some horrific attack being brought down upon them by me. It would be inadvertent, to be sure. Who could possibly know from what direction it might come? I might offend some great warlord, or perhaps the gods would take an interest in my relative peace and feel that some new tumult must be unleashed upon me. And during those sleepless nights, I would tell myself the same thing. Leave. Leave now. Don't wait for daylight. Fade into the night with no explanation. Get out while there's still time, while these people still have bamboo roofs over their heads. On a couple of occasions, I even went so far as to pack a bag with the meager belongings the good farmers had provided me. Just go. Just go, the voice would keep telling me. Yet the rising of the sun would still see me in residence in Howl's Bayou, because there was some small part of me, and I hang my cynical head in shame even to admit it, that held out hope for a happy ending, that I would live out my days in peace and contentment as a simple farmer, that this agricultural life of planting and tilling and cutting down the wheat would last, that I would find a young woman in the village to marry and we would have little red-haired, narrowed-eyed children. There was a chance that the gods had finally taken pity on me and brought me to this place to reside quietly and harmlessly until I finally took the long sleep and perhaps my body would be laid in the fields to provide fertilizer for the next season's crops. And so I stayed. The time continuing apace. Every so often, strangers would pass through. Whenever they did so, I would hide in my hut and worry that this was it. This was the disaster that was going to cost these poor bastards their livelihoods and homes. All because they had shown me kindness. But that was never the case. Inevitably, they would depart, leaving the village unharmed. When they did, I would let out a great sigh and relax, feeling as if the people and I had narrowly escaped a killing blow. There was one night, well, a day and a night actually, that stirred up that feeling more than any other time. A day during which the sun never emerged, not once from behind a solid blanket of black clouds. No work got done that day, as the farmers stood about and looked at the skies. There was much mumbling about the gods and the end of times and the sense of unnatural in the air. There was a steady rumbling of thunder so relentless I thought it was going to drive me mad. Lightning flashed across the skies at random intervals, throughout the day and all through the night. But it was pale blue lightning, giving it an even more ensorcelled and otherworldly feel. I, along with many of the farmers, was up much of the night, staring at the night skies, which looked much as they had during the day. I felt as if I was one of those people who had been severely struck upon the head and was endeavoring to stay awake, since to go to sleep could well mean death. It was the same sensation here, the feeling that if I went to sleep, there would be no world for me to wake up to. Toward the wee morning hours, however, I did doze, and the next thing I knew, it was approaching noon. The sky had cleared, the clouds had dissolved, and it was a glorious day. Everything smelled new, and the feelings of gloom and disaster that had pervaded the previous day were already distant memories. Oddly, I couldn't help but feel that all of us had gotten some sort of reprieve. It was a sensation that began to haunt me, the feeling that there was more going on than I knew about. This was most disconcerting to me, for that which I did not know about and did not understand would be the most likely source of trouble in the future. Expect nothing. Anticipate everything. That was my motto. If there were things occurring that I could not anticipate, it left me vulnerable. Worse, it left me discouraged. Double Chin sensed my mood.
What troubles you, Paul?
Ho being much easier for him to say than apropos. I was dining with them, and Luncheon was busy cleaning up after our meal.
I feel worry.
About what?
About what will come. About the life I lead. About many things, my friend.
He and Luncheon exchanged looks. Luncheon initially had disliked me, but she had come to, at the very least, willingly tolerate me. So if Double Chin was concerned about me, his spouse felt likewise.
You lack balance, Paul.
Perhaps.
No, perhaps. You lack balance. You have no inner peace.
Well, that much I'd have to concede. Inner peace and I are not ideal companions. Believe me, I would like nothing better.
You can find it.
All right. Where exactly would I find it?
Chinpan Ali.
Lun and Double looked at each other and smiled gently.
Certainly you have seen the hut on the outskirts of the village.
I nodded. It was a decent-sized hut.
I've never seen anyone go in or out. I thought it was for storage.
No. In that place dwells Chinpan Ali, the wisest of us all.
He's your village elder?
Actually, it is said he is older than the village. Older than everyone.
And how has he achieved such extreme old age?
Through his studies and discipline. And most importantly, and I believe this will be the most pertinent aspect as far as you are concerned, through peace of mind. His calm is legendary. It is said it is impossible to cause anger within the breast of Chinpan Ali.
All living creatures should have inner peace. They should understand the way of nature. The way of the water.
The water?
We are as the water, Paul. That which ripples our surface sooner or later disappears without a trace. And we have but to wait and allow it to happen. If you can be as calm and still as the water, your worries would likewise vanish, never to be seen again.
That would be nice.
Chinpan Ali can help you with this. I cannot guarantee that he would teach you. For none can predict the actions of Chinpan Ali or the direction they will take, but...
Truth to tell, my friends, I'm not looking for a teacher. I'm afraid that I'm a bit set in my ways.
The wise man knows his lack of wisdom and will learn from whoever he can, wherever he can. You are never too old, Paul. Never. And learning is not confined to one's youth. It's a practice of a lifetime.
I'll consider it.
Do not consider. It is to be done.
Yes, ma'am.
So it was that next morning I found myself standing outside the hut of Chinpan Ali. My hand hovered over the exterior of the hut for a heartbeat or 10. There was no answer.
Ali? Chinpan Ali?
An old man stared out at me, and he was the most elderly person I had ever encountered. He was a head shorter than I, and I wasn't all that tall to begin with. His skin was incredibly wrinkled. It was said that in order to know the age of a tree, you cut it open and count the number of rings on the stump. This always seemed a pointless exercise to me, because in order to determine the tree's age, you killed it and effectively render it moot. It doesn't matter how old it was, it's not going to get any older. But Chimpan Ali's face had so many folds that I couldn't help but think counting them would enable me to divine his age. He had no hair atop his head, and the thinnest sliver of white beard clinging to his chin. He also had thick white eyebrows that tailed upward, giving him a perpetually quizzical appearance. His eyes, however, were captivating. They were very dark and intense, and when he stared at me, it was as if he was boring a hole right through my head. He said nothing, just gazed at me as if he simultaneously was expecting me and also had no desire to see me. My name is Apropos. Was an unusual agglomeration, no syllables for them. But I felt constrained to give my full name rather than the simple Po they'd been used to referring to me. I was told I should come to you. He said nothing. His brow furrowed slightly and his eyes glittered, although I couldn't tell if they did so in amusement or annoyance. The problem when one person doesn't speak is that the other often feels the need to fill in the air with words. I haven't been sleeping well. I worry all the time about the people here, which if you knew me, you would know is somewhat unusual for me, and I, well, you see, it... My greatest asset had always been my silver-tongued nature. I had thoroughly mastered Chimpanese, so I had no ready excuse as to why I couldn't string syllables together. I felt like a right fool. What in the world was it about this wizened man that made it difficult for me to communicate? And before I could mangle this first meeting any further...
What do you seek?
I seek peace of mind, knowledge. I'm tired of feeling miserable all the time, of being cynical. It's exhausting, always expecting the worst of any given situation. I'm tired of self-loathing, tired of being afraid to be happy. I seek a way of coping with the day-to-day stress of being me.
Go away.
Go away? No, go away. You don't understand. I was practically bullied into coming here. I was told that you could help make things better for me. It took a hell of a lot for me to come up to you and ask you for your help, because I don't generally seek out help from anybody.
Go away.
I grabbed his shoulder. I could feel the bones beneath his simple clothing. Now wait just a minute. He turned and his eyes opened wide and fixed upon me with such a fearsome gaze that I felt as if someone had just put the evil eye upon me. Then he looked at my hand, and I had the sudden, distinct feeling that if he was so inclined, he could break it off at the wrist. I had no reason to fear him. None. And if there was ever an expert in fearing things, it was a fundamental coward such as myself. Nevertheless, I immediately removed my hand from his shoulder. Slowly, his eyes returned to their almost lazy look, and then these words floated from his heart.
Return when you know what you seek.
I stood there for a long moment, and then became aware that someone was watching me. It was Lun Chin, standing next to Double Chin. Then, Lun Chin nodded approvingly.
That went much better than I thought it would.
Clearly, he likes you. That went very well indeed.
Wonderful.